You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today's date being the 14th of March, 2026. It's sad to report that Marcel, Stanley's brother, died on my lap today, a few hours ago, of oral cancer. He was a little scared near the end, but I told him everything was going to be okay, and he eventually calmed down, and then he simply stopped breathing. So, may God grant us a death like that. But it's during Lent, and we realize all of our deaths are going to be something like that, that fear, that terror I saw at the very end. But because I was there, it didn't last very long at all. You know, I'm primarily in a political theorist. They call a someone who studies the history of ideology. But I'm also a comparativist, and that, you know, brings me to the Russo-Ukrainian focus. In other words, it's all based on the idea that political ideas don't exist in and of themselves. They don't exist in thin air. They have to be situated. The living world of a population, a nation, bound by religion, language, race. Being a comparativist means ideas are situated in different contexts. As Iran is on the front page every day, I thought it proper that a deep dive into the ideology of the revolution of 1979 is sorely needed. So again, I have to do it, and the propaganda and the childish attacks are not helping anybody. Now, everyone knows the overwhelming majority of Muslims are Sunni. But the political structures of Sunni states are quite secular. They don't really correspond to what's articulated in the Quran or the Hadith, which of course the Shiites reject. In their mind, the Shiites is only one Muslim state that corresponds to the Islamic concept in both form and content, and that is of course Iran. Of course, at the same time, Iran's the only nation where 90% or so of the population is Shiite. But you have plenty of other places where it's a majority. Iraq, almost. Azerbaijan, Yemen, people forget about that. They have huge minorities. And Bahrain is almost a bare majority, and plenty of places where they are a substantial minority, like Lebanon. Today, Iran has proven itself to be a match for the dying empire, and of course, closely aligned with Russia and China. The Shiites are quite different from the Muslims we normally deal with, the Sunnis. So I think the study of the Shiite philosophical concept, especially in politics, as embedded in Iran's political institutions and especially practice, is very important. For those of you who have E. Michael Jones' Logos Rising, he puts a great amount of importance in the year 1979. All over the world, in fact, radical things began happening. The revolution in Iran just being one. But under the Shah, westernization meant drug abuse, prostitution, easy divorce. They were everywhere in Iran. Many Muslims, even moderate ones, were fearing that their whole tradition would be lost forever. And then the Shah recognized Israel. At the end of Logos Rising, Jones said this: 1979 Iran is a rejection of the sexual revolution every bit as much as it was a rejection of communism. However, in 1989, his successor, that is to say, Khomeini's successor, legalized birth control, and Iran saw a huge drop in her fertility, Later, facing a dropping population, Khamenei said it was a worse mistake and he begged Allah for forgiveness. Remember, Iranians burned down their movie theaters and birth control clinics that year. But that year, also in the Shiite tradition, had been foretold as the year where the Mahdi, or the Messiah, would arrive. Many other things. The counter-revolution in Poland, invasion of Afghanistan, many other things occurred that year. Now, we'll talk more about this later, but it seems that in punishment for the overthrow of the Shah, the U.S. and the Israelis engineered what we know as the Iran-Iraq War, which was absolutely horrific. I call it the Islamic version of World War I, with Iraq as the American proxy. For 35 years, Orthodox Russia and Iran have been allies. Jones says it's the mirror image of the alliance between the U.S. and the Mujahideen against the USSR. And maybe it's going to have the same result. Now, as far as the topic goes, modern Iran, building this Islamic Republic, there's a few major political and philosophical issues that they had to solve within the framework of Shiite Islam. So among the Shiites, the Imam, the Imanet, that's the Shiite state itself, or the rule of the Imams, is recognized as one of the pillars of faith, one of the dogmatic foundations of Islam. Of course, the Sunnis reject that completely. Now, many of you know, after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, the question of who would hold supreme authority in the Muslim community, the Ummah, that became a huge issue, and it sparked a profound schism. As is well known, two points of view emerged, which developed into political platforms and philosophical doctrines. One assumed the elective authority, so-called principle of Ridan, a community's preference for someone as a spiritual authority. The spiritual authority's name was Adadan. Oh, by the way, the words and names I have to pronounce here, you got to give me a break, okay? The institution of elective authority, the election of a ruler by the male part of the community, and that became the doctrine of Igma, the electoral principle. The term Adadan, it began to alter its definition. It became something like the sole legitimate claimants of supreme power, by the way, which negates the whole democratic idea of the principle. But Islamic history demonstrated that the principle of election became a convenient pretext for the usurpation of power by the caliphs and practically became an entire denial of the imperative of the doctrine of Igma. So when the Muslim community outgrew the framework within which mechanisms it outgrew the tribal community, could be governed. States emerged in the Arab world. The doctrine of Igma was essentially removed. And, of course, the dynasties were established. And the doctrine of the Imam, or the Imanet, as a theocratic principle, was advanced by many others. Now, the Imam literally means the man standing out front. Sometimes it's the helmsman. It also means the spiritual leader of the local ummah, and it presupposes the exclusive right to rule the Islamic state as the descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. Shiites hold that the cycle of prophecy, culminating in the seal of the Prophet Muhammad, must be followed by something called the cycle of the Wala. Since Allah can't abandon us, or his people, Muslims, those who carry out his will must guide it. Walaya means something along the lines of friendship, but implies protection for the other. Shiites consider all prophets and imams to be the elite, those specially chosen, and they entrust themselves to their authority. And this is how a Shiite attains self-knowledge. The political idea among the Shiites, only the imams, that is, the descendants of Ali and Fatima, of course, you know, the prophet's son-in-law and daughter, only their descendants have a right to govern the Muslim community. Imams are bearers of what's called the divine substance that makes them infallible. They possess hidden knowledge, and their judgments are the ultimate authority. And therefore, the Shiite imam cannot be elected. So long as the Shiite Ali dynasty in northern Iran, roughly 9th and 10th centuries, continued, the Shiites despite active Sunni resistance, nevertheless maintained both an imam and an imanate in their original understanding. This was a political successor of the Prophet and the continuation of this very same cycle of the Prophets. In 874, the 11th Imam, Hasan al-Askari, the last truly authenticated direct descendant of Ali, he died. And according to some, he left no heir. But classical 12-fold Shiism, the Twelvers, is based on the doctrine that Hasan al-Askari had a son, Muhammad al-Mahdi, who mysteriously disappeared on the day of his father's death. The Twelver Shiites believe that this Mahdi, or Messiah, he left the world, becoming invisible, but remaining in the souls of his followers. In her 2017 article, The Socio-Philosophical Idea of the Shiite State, this is in Russian, Victoria Serena wrote the following. The period of Mahdi's absence from the world is called the period of occultation, that is to say, to be hidden. In Shiism, occult means that which is hidden. The period is divided between the lesser and greater occultations. The lesser one lasted 70 years, during which the imam was elected by four naibs, through whom the faithful could communicate with the ruler. The first naib was likely introduced to the Shiites by Askari himself, then each subsequent one appointed his successor, sometimes confirmed by letters from the hidden imam. This continued into the last one, Ali Samari, and he decided not to appoint his successor. Thus, the time of the Great Occultation began, which continues to this day, during which the Shiites have no direct connection with their imam. However, the hidden imam, like the Christian Messiah, will return to the world during the apocalypse to once again assume leadership of the Shiites. Now, since the death of the last naib, the creation of an ideal, righteous Shiite state became possible only after the return of the Mahdi at the end of time. That means any authority became temporary and illegitimate, and any real ruler and usurper of the hidden imam's authority. This state of affairs led to the absence of any state building among the Twelver Shiites until the establishment of the Safavid, or the Sufi Empire, in the 16th century. Now, they had to confirm their legitimacy among Shiites here. So the Safavids created a legend claiming that 6th century imam was the founder of their dynasty. But that wasn't enough. For the deputy of this hidden imam needed not only to confirm and justify his affiliation with the Prophet's family, but also receive his appointment from the hidden imam personally. Well, the latter was pretty difficult, and the Shiite concept of the state, even before the Salafids came to power, the Shiite ulema, the community, proposed replacing this direct indication of the imam for the successor with the consent of the entire community with his candidacy, in effect, adopting the Sunni method of election. But this also led to a rejection, or at least a partial rejection, of something that was quite fundamental to the Shia. Now, to gain legitimacy here, the Safavids had to rely on the Shiite clergy, and they had to develop a new political idea. The concept of Wilayat al-Faqih became a new Shia political, this very same new concept. Now, it stipulates that during the imam's occultation, or being hidden, the community should be led by theologians and jurists, lawyers of various types. Now, this was not invented by the Ayatollah Khomeini, although many think so, but it arose immediately after the death of the 11th imam as a response to the challenges of political practice. You can't not have a state, while the Sunnis did, among others. So in a letter to one of the Shiites during the minor occultation, Imam Mahdi himself wrote the following. Concerning the questions you will face during the minor occultation, address these questions to the people who transmit our tradition. They are my proof over you, and I am Allah's proof over them. Now the Faqih replaces the hidden 12th Imam, thereby allowing for the creation of a just society without waiting for his revelation. To a great extent, this is where Iran comes from. The Ayatollah wrote that, quote, the duty of the Faqih is to spread religion and instruct people in the approaches, rituals, institutions of Islam in order to pave the way in society for the application of Islamic law and the establishment of Islamic institutions. Khomeini believed that during the period of occultation, a just faqih possesses authority equal to that of the Prophet and the Imams, though obviously not equal to them in holiness, but in terms of practical function in governing a nation. So, since Islamic legislation is immutable, the faqih is able to correctly apply it, has a legitimate right to it. The Ayatollah, in his Islamic Authority, more famous works, he came out against monarchy, and succession to the throne is a vicious method of governance that contradicts Islam. Of course, we know who he's talking about. In an article, also in Russian, by Tamaz Makov and Semed Semedov, came out in 2010, Khomeiniism as an ideology of political Islam, it reads this. This is what it says. Khomeini held no official position, but was considered the Rabar, the leader of Iran, with broad powers. Article 110 of the Iranian Constitution granted him broad powers in the areas of legislative, executive, and judicial authority, matters of war and peace, the appointment and dismissal of officials, etc. The fundamental difference between the Shiite and Sunni versions of Islamic democracy is that the ultimate authority rests with the faqih, who, unlike the president or parliament, is not elected by anyone. The Iranian constitution provides a mechanism for some popular influence in the selection of the faqih. A council of experts is elected through general elections, comprising individuals qualified to elect the country's leader. Members of the council appoint the leader and present him to the nation. Did Khomeini actually have the right to rule Iran? And the answer, from the point of view of the Shiite mentality, is yes. He was a member of the ancient Sayyid family. He was descended from the seventh holy Imam Musa Kazim, and therefore from the Prophet Muhammad himself through his son-in-law Ali and his daughter Fatima. Belonging to the Prophet's lineage allowed him to wear a black turban while everyone else wore the white one. Serena continues. Ahmad Naraki was the first to clearly formulate the political responsibilities of Islamic theology. During that, ensuring stability and order in the life of society is the direct responsibility of the faqih. At the same time, his student, the renowned faqih, Sheikh Murtada Ansari, criticized his teacher, arguing that the competence of the faqih should be limited only to issues related to prayer. Despite this, Ansari played a major role in the transformation of the concept of the Shia faqih. In his writings, he laid the foundations for this teaching in theological schools, established a centralized leadership of the clergy and all kinds of things. Mara Aya is a spiritual leader worthy of emulation, also arose. Later, the spiritual and material centralization of Shiite society, led by the institution of the Mara Aya, allowed for the creation of the Islamic Republic of Iran in its modern form. Now, Iran's first constitution was in 1906. And the question of the Shia clergy at the time was whether and how the Wilayat al-Faqih and democratic institutions could be combined somehow. There were several faqihs, al-Manaini and Fadawala, led to fundamental changes in how the Shiites approached the state. Naini thought that the faqih should have the right to oversee the legislative branch to ensure that everything conformed to Islamic principles. Esfadullah believed that the issues of Sharia, judicial rulings, etc., argumentation, laws concerning life of the people should fall within the purview of the viceroys of the hidden imam. But the secular aspects, like, you know, politics, power, should fall within the purview of the Muslim ruler. So that was a division within the early 20th century among the Shiites. Now the next issue occurred during the reign of the infamous Pahlavi dynasty. There was a struggle for sovereignty of their state, and under that dynasty came under the economic and political control of other powers, and we know who that was. That's when Ali Shirati and Ruhollah Khomeini formulated the concept of Wilayat al-Faqih in its modern form. Ali Shirati, very famous, he received a European education, became acquainted with the popular ideas of both the New Left and the New Right in Europe. Therefore, he was a supporter of militant Islam, but also was educated in various other ideologies. He wanted to see the militant Islam, the militant Islamic movement, participate in military operations against tyrants on the side of the nation. And that will bring the return of the Mahdi closer. So at the head of this ideal state that Shariati had envisioned was an informed individual, a man possessing knowledge, aware of the problems of society, feeling responsible for the fate of Islam and his people. But he understood knowledge not as a result of a secular or even religious education, but as a divine light, illuminating one who is chosen. The concept of chosenness is very important. That was the initially undergirded the Shiite imanit. And he created the ideological basis for the formation of a Shiite state. And this practical model developed by, of course, the Ayatollah Khomeini. Khomeini outlined first the provisions of the political and legal model of the Islamic state. And, of course, Islamic rule, also a very famous work of his. That became the theoretical basis for the writing of the Constitution of Iran. Before formulating the practical foundations, though, Khomeini had to resolve another philosophical question of Shiism. Who should hold supreme power if the imam is hidden and the successor has not been appointed? So he concluded that a Shiite state should have a distinct form of government, an Islamic republic, and the best you can do, that it should be governed by various elected bodies, as we've already mentioned. Not just any elected bodies, but those from the responsible ones. Now, some of this was seditious for traditional Shiism, since at the time, any elected head of state or government body is illegitimate. But he was quite eloquent, and he demonstrated the necessity of the existence and, you know, basic functioning of the Shia state in the absence of the Messiah. And of course, he also said that the faqih were always there to exercise oversight over elected bodies. So he noted that both the imam and the faqih governing the state and society are guided by the same laws bequeathed to the community by the Prophet. So, in practice, there's no difference between the faqih, the imam, or even the Prophet himself. It's either that or be overrun by every Sunni or whatever that actually has a state or even an empire. These are pressing needs. You have things like juridical decisions, taxes, security. They need constant leadership. And during the imam's occultation, no one but a faqih, an expert in Shia law, can competently provide any kind of leadership whatsoever. So today, obviously, Iran is the only state based on Shiite law, the only Islamic republic in the world that tries to combine modern ideas of revolution and traditional Islamic ones. But Iran is a striking example. These contradictions between religion and the realities of political practice can be overcome. And as far as anyone can tell, it's been a success, especially under the conditions in which it's developed. Now, the Shiites, following the work of Ja'far al-Sadiq, considered the source of doctrine of the imminent primarily to be the Quran itself. Now, this was allegedly distorted under the Caliph Uthman in 651, which is very early, of course. A trader and a merchant, like most of them were, immediately, of course, formed an army. That's what Islam essentially is. A year earlier, he did notice differences between and among Quranic versions as Islam expanded. So he ordered a committee to use Caliph Abu Bakr's copy and prepare a standardized version of the Quran. This is 20 years of Muhammad's death, maybe. It was committed to written form. Now, that text became the model from which all other versions of the Quran came from. All other versions were burnt by Uthman. Now, the Shia use the same Quran as the Sunni, but the Shia don't believe that it was first compiled by Uthman. Rather, the Shiites believe the Quran was gathered and compiled by Muhammad during his lifetime. According to Shiite belief, the Imam Ali, the Prophet's second cousin and son-in-law, and his sons Hassan and Hussein, also relatives of the Imam Ali, had no question that they had a right to rule over the Islamic community, according to his will. After their death, power in society was to belong to the Imams, who were truly righteous. The last one, of course, is Mahdi, the concealed prophet, temporarily hidden, and of course, as I said, will return to Day of Judgment. And of course, you had even further schisms. After the death of Imam Ali's sons, this is going way back, of course, Hassan and Hussein, the Hanifs emerged, people who declare one of Ali's sons to be the successors of the throne. And you had an army of other people who, and it gets very complicated, the Ismailis, it should be noted, though, that the supporters of the Ali dynasty, they did achieve political success. But Shia dynasties began to rule regardless of all of this. In Yemen, in Egypt, the Fatimids were Shiites. In Syria, the Hamanids. In Iran, the Buyids. And even in the eastern part of Arabia, the Ismailis. Now, modern Shiism rejects Ismailism as a branch of Shiism. But to the four fundamental religious dogmas of Sunni Islam, monotheism, divine justice, prophecy of the afterlife, and belief in the afterlife, the Shiites have a fifth, the recognition of the absolute, sacred, and social legitimacy of the imamate, or the rule of the imams. This doctrine is extremely powerful and rules Iran completely. But the imam, or the imamate, appears as the most important, almost cosmic force. They call it the emanation of the internal divine light. The imams are the executors of divine commands, the highest authorities, leaders of the community, even miraculous communication with the hidden imam, the Mahdi himself. Another writer I was reading on this, this is a doctoral dissertation, Fayal Ibyatov. He writes, again, in 2010, his Political Philosophy and Social Doctrine of the Iranian Shiite Revolution. This is what he says. Historically, a significant portion of Muslims rejected Shiite dogma and the Ali dynasty, which resulted in bitter civil war within Arab and Iranian society. Of course, Iranians are Persians, not Arab. The ideological and political struggle became particularly intense at the end of the era of the rightly guided caliph, and that was in 661. The very beginning of this struggle, Imam Ali and his sons, the rightly guided Imams Hassan and Hussein, who died in 680, they perished. Under the first Umayyad caliph, the political tide turned in favor of the supporters of the elective principle among Shiites. They had their own arguments based on the statements of the Prophet, formulated the main postulate of the socio-political doctrine of Islam, where there is no direct indication of the desirability of the rule of the descendants of Ali, etc. But the most important thing that formed the basis of Sunni political doctrine was the following statement of the Prophet about the submission of the faithful. This is my advice for you. Fear Allah, the Almighty and the Great, and listen to obey, even if a slave commands you. Indeed, whoever among you lives long enough will see much discord, and therefore you should adhere to my sunnah and the sunnah of my righteous caliphs, who were guided by the right path without deviating from it in anything and completely avoiding innovation, for every innovation is a misconception. So it's clear, Sunni theologians, any member of the tribe, the Prophet's tribe, who has received the consent and religious sanction of the Ummah, that is to say the community, can become a caliph. Among the Sunnis, you have the four rightly guided caliphs, the relatives of the Prophet, recognize the principle of succession, power and principle of the, of course, with the Igma, or the goodwill of the community. Shiism, of course, very different. This is a result of the schism, the Islamic schism in this case. This is a profound religious and this tradition, a profound expression in many religions, of course. We know them very well, Catholics know them. And it's closely linked to the eschatological issue. all religions really without exception. Although I don't think, you know, Buddhism, that's not really a religion, but we're talking about, you know, Islam and Christianity. It's usually a fierce, persistent struggle for the purification of religion and the return of religious tradition in its original form. That's the traditionalist revolution, but that can always go too far and end up being some self-contained movement that rejects authority entirely. Among the Shiites, the schism is intense. This factor, the incessant and really incapable of ending until the arrival of the Mahdi. This search for the true faith make the Shiism and the imminent, in the highest sense, attractive almost in a secular sense, for a mass revolutionary movement in Islamic countries. Let me quote Khomeini again. And this is a kind of an odd statement. He wrote this many, many years ago. Islam is not limited to prayer and pilgrimage alone. Islamic laws do not simply require the performance of obligatory ritual prayers and pilgrimage. This is just one part of Islamic law. Islam deals with politics, with governing the country. Islamic laws make it possible to govern large nations. Presidents of Islamic countries, crown heads, and governments are responsible for the representation of Islam that the world receives. Now, I didn't think there was any doubt about this. Islam is inherently military and political. Muhammad was still alive when they were conquering places. But remember the context here. The context was when he was writing this, remember, he started writing in the 20s. This was a terrible time when the West was colonizing Islamic areas. It was a time of tremendous Islamic defeat. But he clarifies this elsewhere. The Ayatollah says, Shiism is a revolutionary movement, a continuation of the true Mohammedan Islam, like the Shiites themselves, they've always been subject to vile attacks and oppression by despots and colonialists. Distinctive, innate characteristic of Shiism from its very beginning to this day, the struggle against evil and dictatorship, and the entire history of the Shiites bears witness to this. So in Iran, Shiism is viewed as a revolutionary movement and revolutionary ideology. The idea of fighting for the purification of the faith is essential after the period of defeat under the colonization and everything else. This presupposes the political significance of the imminent. That's the most important concept of building a state, the Islamic state. It can be argued within the framework of this doctrine. Any social advancement really is accessible to the broader segments of the population. Ibiatov, who I mentioned already, he's talking about the massive difference between Sunni and Shiite that partially led to the revolution of 1979. Sunni Islam, especially the more extreme sects, has no cult of saints. Holy places, burial sites of Islamic saints, other entities associated with the lives of actual living saints are rejected by the Sunni theologians as idolatry. Shiism, like Orthodoxy, meaning Greek Orthodoxy, has a highly developed cult where the sacred ones and places, graves are especially revered. Even the Imams Ali, Hassan, Hussein, other saints, etc. Even the worship of springs, trees, and various holy places is not excluded. Thus, Shiism is a branch of Islam characterized by more intimately connected to the individual, emphasizing the importance of volitional action and respect for the individual's will and their personal capacity to draw closer to God. Shiism elevates the man, offers him the opportunity to personally connect with the sacred and fulfill the will of the Almighty, which can undoubtedly be interpreted within the framework of conceptual philosophy, as a manifestation of religious democracy and a true love for freedom. The transcendence of Sunni Islam became the basis for the emergence of these spiritless movements in Islam like Wahhabism. From Saudi Arabia, an extreme form of Islamic Protestantism. You could even call it a form of Calvinism. This is a very extreme social movement. It prioritizes bourgeois values. It advocates for the restoration of the original Islam. Wahhabism preaches the denial of saints and holiness on earth. It embodies a total lack of spirituality and rationalism. The Puritanism of Wahhabist ideologies is effectively aimed at promoting hoarding and hucksterism, the fundamental anti-values of bourgeois morality. claiming to be the official ideology of Saudi Arabia, Wahhabism is not only embraces Western liberal value systems, but also serves as an Islamic conduit for the political strategy of Euro-American Atlanticism. That's a deadly serious statement. Remember, it wasn't the Shiites who took Constantinople and who colonized southeastern Europe. It was the Shiites, rather, who backed Orthodox Russia against the Muslims of Chechnya, among other places. The Shiites are a very different group in comparison to what we normally consider a Muslim. And normally when most people say it, you think of the Sunni, even think of the Saudi Wahhabist movement. It wouldn't really be an exaggeration to talk about chivalry, this kind of altruism, patriotism and self-sacrifice, the most universal norms of spiritual nobility. It's important to emphasize the strategic vector of this morality in Iranian society, especially when you contrast it to life before 1979. It took a while for Shiism, and we're talking way before 1979, in the ancient world, it took a long time to establish the Shiites to establish themselves in Iran. It took a long religious search, and for this reason, now surprisingly, corresponds to Iranian cultural and religious tradition. Iran encountered Islam in a state of profound political, religious, and philosophical decline. Only after a long period of accustoming itself to Islam as a cult of conquerors, which of course it always was, did the Iranians, consciously, at least at the level of the new elite, embrace Islamic doctrine, seeing in Islam a new path for the revival of what they had. So it didn't, you know, the idea of the imam didn't emerge out of nothing. You're talking about a unique cultural, historical basis, foundation, and ultimately leading to what happened in 1979. The ideology of Khomeini comes down to the fact that he borrowed ideas, words, and even slogans from the non-Muslim world. He used a lot of slogans from third world populism. This is why I call it a national socialist or a social nationalist idea. Sadiati, as I mentioned before, very popular in the 70s. This was really, and he was huge in the formation of Khomeini's political views. Islam is a religion of irreconcilable individuals striving for truth and justice. It is a religion of those who desire freedom, independence. It is a school of struggle against imperialism. But the servants of imperialism presented Islam in a completely different light. They created a false concept of Islam in the minds of the people. Now this is Khomeini. The distorted concept of Islam that they taught in religious schools was aimed at removing from Islam its revolutionary essence, preventing Muslims from rising up and winning freedom, performing rituals of Islam, establishing governments that would ensure happiness, prosperity, and a dignified life for human beings in Muslim countries. The Islamic State, as we already hinted, came about through a large number of innovations, all kinds of Western borrowings. Article 2 of the Iranian Constitution said that the state is based, among other things, on the belief in continuous ijtihad, the right and the ability of a competent jurist to independently interpret Muslim laws. They could resolve, you know, controversies and even political issues on the basis of Quran, guided by the methods of the fiqh, Muslim jurisprudence. Khomeini, following the teachings of the ideologist, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, Sayyid Qutb, died in 1966. He holds that it's necessary to gradually displace a non-Islamic government, creating a network of alternative economic, social, legal, and cultural and other institutions. And he has four things. It's necessary, number one, to terminate relations with government agencies totally. Two, to never cooperate with them. Three, to do nothing that would benefit them. And four, create new legal, financial, economic, cultural, and political bodies in their place. Well, Not cooperating with them, doing nothing to benefit them, would suggest that you don't pay taxes, and certainly don't get drafted. It was a campaign of civil disobedience. The mid-1970s, this network was controlled by Khomeini. That became the only real alternative to the Shah's government. At this time, the country's economic and political life was paralyzed by strikes. This is in 1978. Pahlavi made an unexpected decision. Without any consultation or negotiation, he proposed Shapur Bakhtiar, who died in 91, one of the leaders of the National Front, that he form a government of his own liking. He was the final prime minister of the royal state. The Shah's struggle with Khomeini was approaching its end. While voluntarily renouncing the Shah's power, the monarch simultaneously favored the moderate bourgeoisie and transferred power to them, believing this to be the last chance to resist the claims of the politicized clergy. The end of January 1979, having been in exile for 15 years, Khomeini returned to Islam from Paris and called for a new phase of the revolution, the transition to Islamic rule. And he created the Supreme Revolutionary Council, and that became the government. February 1st, Khomeini appointed the leader of the freedom movement in Iran, Mehdi Bazargan. That was a new prime minister, the first prime minister of the revolutionary state. There was an armed clash in the middle of February 1979 at the air base in Tehran, and the Shah's men were going over to the side of the rebels, and it was over. Bakhtiar, appointed by the Shah, the last prime minister, he fled the country. It was announced on national television that he had won, and he became the first spiritual leader of the Islamic Republic. Revolutionary committees, they sprung up everywhere. And this is what happens after revolutions. And this was, in a way, this was to be inaccurate, probably a right-wing revolution, certainly a national one. But there was no real legal norms here. They executed a whole bunch of the Shah's Savak organization, officers, civil servants. Khomeini's primary task, though, was to transform the mess that was Iran, to control this kind of violence and subordinate everything to central state authority, which is now, of course, the Islamic State. Just like the Taliban in Afghanistan, he had to be strict. It had to be centralized. He had to do what he had to do as far as Sharia law is concerned. Article 21 of the Constitution, it obliges the state to create conditions for the full development of women as individuals and the realization of their material and moral rights. They were a huge part of the Islamic Revolution. This is because the sexual revolution and the total degeneracy of Iranian society was clear under the Shah. So they called it the woman's emancipation in the Muslim sense. But the status of women is pretty much in the traditional way, as it always has been and should be. Now, the economic concept of the revolution is a concept of Tawhid, the Tawhid economy, as they call it. Now, this was outlined by Khomeini's economic advisor, and he was soon elected president, Abu Hassan Bandisadr, who died in 2021. And he wrote the book Tawhid Economy. That was just before the revolution. He contrasted an economy based on Islamic principles with the economy that had developed during the Shah, under the Shah. But in 81, a few years later, he was exiled. He was becoming a westernizer. He actually left Iran disguised as a woman. It's amazing how quickly this occurred. He helped create the American-funded National Council of Resistance of Iran, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but the program is simply the demand for a secular state, you know, gender equality, etc. I've been through their website. But they also run camps for armed militants, Camp Ashraf, situated north of the Iraqi town of Al-Khalis, about 44 miles from Iran's western border. Now, the Iraqi army destroyed it in 2011, killed 11 people. Then it was replaced by Camp Liberty, using a former American military base in Baghdad. So this National Council is the legal wing of the propaganda ministry of the People's Mujahideen organization, which is in Albania and Paris, and I'm sure they're there today, which is a violent group seeking a violent overthrow of the Iranian state. It's odd, it uses a rifle and sickle rather than the hammer and sickle as its official symbol. Human Rights Watch, of all people, issued a report, No Exit, Human Rights Abuses Inside the MKO Camps. MKO, that People's Mujahideen. They describe prison camps with severe human rights abuses against its members, prolonged isolation, solitary confinement, and even outside of prison, verbal, psychological abuse being the norm, coerced confessions, everything like that. But still, while the man was in Iran, Banisadr argued that the Tawhid system should be a mixed economy. According to Article 44 of the Iranian Constitution, public property, that is to say, property under the state and local bodies, included the main branches of industry, foreign trade, mining, the large mining enterprises, water pipelines, dams, banking, insurance, radio, television, the post office, telegraph, civil aviation, shipping, highways, and all of these other clearly public goods. And most of these are under state control all over the place. But it generally only applied to, you know, heavy industry with very large corporations. The Constitution enshrined the nationalization of large private property accumulations, especially that of foreign capital, banks and insurance companies. So they got a lot of people mad. So Iran, at least for a short time, had to abandon the principles of the Tawhid economics. They liberalized a little bit. That phase has long ended, and there's no question as to Iran's economic success over the decades. Kalim Siddiqui, who really thought that the caliphate could be restored, he said, all nation states must be necessarily liquidated. And Khomeini was named as a leader of the global Islamic movement, and eventually the single imam. They even believed that other people, so-called people of the book, which is essentially Christians, does not include Talmudists, of course. That's a book, but that's not just any book. Would create what's called their own idiocratic politics to jointly embody the kingdom of God on earth. You'll see that in the Shia, not so much, of course, in the among the Sunni. Something called realized eschatology. Eschatology, I should say. Certain events associated with the end of time may be possible here and now. See, traditional Shiism believes that a just society can be created only after the Messiah is here. Islamists understood the path to a worldwide caliphate, but that would be a long one. Siddiqui made a significant contribution to this. The notion of the transitional period, the interval between the emergence of the Muslim vanguard and the establishment of the caliphate. And he emphasized that really there's no clear geographical boundary between Islam and its enemies. He wrote about the diffuse structure of the Islamic world. And he put forth the idea that I was writing about 20 years ago, concerning our people, of course, the Islamic non-territorial state. Now, thinking in terms of ethnicity. Now, Anatoly Yezhov is a scholar who writes on this stuff, and he says, this is not tied to a specific territory, has a structure like a network, functions within non-Islamic in the non-Islamic world in parallel with existing countries, and is formed mainly by diaspora Muslims. Towards this end, Siddiqui says, an Islamic revolution is the stage where the Islamic movement transforms a region or a country into an Islamic state. Now, he doesn't state it directly, but he does imply that an Islamic non-territorial state existing through and outside of British society, talking about Britain, of course, and having come into conflict with the institutions of kufr, that is, unbelief, will defend itself and accordingly launch a counteroffensive in order to carry out a coup or defeat the opposing structures by armed means. Of course, that requires open borders and bringing these people into Britain and whatever other society they're in. Now we get into some very unpleasant things. But this is the expectations that came in 1979. Attempts to export this revolution began. The Iranian model, in quotes, was something that was talked about a lot. The idiocratic state. Now they claim, in general, that they don't want to pursue selfish national interests in foreign policy. The only thing they care about is to spread an ideology as widely as possible. So while the national state has no higher values or motives than its own desires and impulses, and I've said things like this in the past, the Islamic State under this conception will fulfill a mission to make the law of the Creator the supreme authority over all systems of statehood, something I agree with, just not Islamic. Khomeini emphasized that the entire world was the object of the revolution's export. But Islam defended not just Muslims, but all oppressed nations. In 1982, a world map was published in Tehran. The USA and its allies were colored black, the USSR and its allies in red, and the territory of the World Islamic Republic with its center in Iran, which included all potentially Muslim countries, including, you know, parts of the USSR and Central Asia, was green. So the Ayatollah wrote, "My divine political covenant is addressed not so much to the great Iranian people, but as a recommendation to all Muslim peoples and the oppressed of the world of all nationalities and all faiths." Now, that kind of thing, it happens after revolutions, you know, and people get excited. But the practicalities of life have, that generation is long gone. And that mentality really doesn't exist, especially when it comes to Russia, which is its main ally. Still, declared at the time that Iran would provide assistance to all the world dispossessed, it doesn't matter who they are, and in fact, that any oppressed person were automatically counted among as Muslims, regardless of what they really think about things. Even Islamic states, though, divided in Iran into fraternal and hostile. The fraternal category also included many secular states, places building Arab socialism like Syria, Algeria, Libya, and even the sort of semi-Marxist South Yemen, because they were based on anti-imperialism and anti-Zionism. So this revolution became a nationalist one, with the religious aspect secondary. The Islamists' ultimate goal was to convert the entire world to Islam and transform humanity into one community. But that's the maximalist idea. But the minimum goal is to achieve at least the re-Islamicization of regions with historically Muslim populations, and even that's too much. But the revolution marked a total breakthrough in the area of global political Islam. And the Sunni world was extremely upset by this, especially among the elite. As I've said many times since the war began, most of the Gulf monarchies, you talk about how the oil pays for everything, education, medical care, whatever they want. They don't pay any taxes. But that only applies to a small percentage of the population that are called citizens, anywhere from 10 to 20%, depending on where you go. Everyone else is a non-citizen, essentially a serf, many of them Shiites. And this is always a problem. This is why the UAE, which is on fire right now, normalized their relations with Israel, because Israel and the U.S., we're leading the world in surveillance technologies. They knew they'd have to take action against their own non-citizens. Khomeini created the Bureau for Liaison with Liberation Movements. In 1982, the law was passed on the protection of world Islamic liberation movements. This bureau established contact with Shiite communities in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Ethiopia, the Philippines, and many other places. However, the enthusiasm for this kind of thing collapsed. September 22, 1980, an Iraqi attack, although it accused Iran of shelling Iraqi cities, began the bloody Iran-Iraq War, lasting almost 8 years, which I think is the longest war of the 20th century. The pretext was a dispute over the border areas along the Shatt al-Arab River, which separates Iran and Iraq. But Iraq's goal, really the West's goal, was to overthrow Khomeini. because there are so many Shiites in Iraq. It seems that the war was waged to exhaust the military and economic potential of the other one, the enemy. You see, Saddam Hussein initially saw the revolution as a good thing because he hated Pahlavi too. But Khomeini slapped his hand away. Very stupid thing. Rather than respond to his positive message, he called for the overthrow of the Ba'ath state. Now, in 1980, Iraq had roughly 250 trained soldiers, which was not the largest in the Arab world. Egypt had a larger army. Had about 2,500 tanks and 350 combat aircraft. We could presume they had trained pilots and trained crews. Iran was starting to lose and lose badly. They ran out of ammunition very quickly, weapons, equipment, foreign military specialists. Iraq relied on foreign supplies. See, in the 1970s, especially after 1975, Iraq spent a long time building up its forces. There was another Iran-Iraq war, a very brief one, 74-75, the Shatt al-Arab conflict with Iran. Never came close to the scale of 1980, but it made Saddam an enemy of the Shah, which is why the revolution was greeted so positively in Baghdad. Regardless, Saddam Hussein was a West ally. He was fighting the Islamic Revolution. He received military aid, chemical, biological weapons from the Americans and the Israelis. And of course, no one won, no one lost. The combined losses of both sides, killed and wounded, were about 1.5 million men. Iran lost roughly 300,000 men killed, Iraq suffering about 120,000 KIA. It really was the Mideast version of World War I. It was mindless, it was bloody, it even used gas. There was large-scale trench warfare, attacks on civilians, chemical attacks. Iraq expected a decisive victory, but Iran did too. And Saddam's point of view made sense because, you know, the minute a revolution takes place, there's chaos. But their invasion stalled in December of 1980. The Iranian military, very motivated, fought back. By June of 1982, they recaptured everything. They're right back to their pre-war borders. Then, overconfident, Iran launched an invasion of Iraq. That lasted for 5 years. Mid-88, Iraq launched a series of attacks. Ultimately, they created the stalemate and brought an end to the war. But, you know, Iran had the whole Western world behind it, as well as the Gulf monarchies. Iraq saw peace from 1988, the end of the war, to 1990, when they invaded Kuwait. Iraq was supported both by the USSR and the U.S. So for Khomeini, it meant that both superpowers were kufr, unbelief. "We're not fighting against Iraq," Khomeini said in 1980. "The people of Iraq support our Islamic revolution. Our conflict is with America. But the American hand can be seen protruding from the sleeve of the Iraqi government." But Iraq, after all, was slightly majority Shiite at the time, and I think it still is. Saudi Arabia, the same thing. It was unsuccessful. Since 1981, though, the main conflict between the two countries have occurred during the Hajj. Tens of thousands of Iranians are always fighting the monarchy there. So, you want to talk about a failure. The war with Iraq and Iran forced the Iranians to shift from military exports to the export of revolution. Iran did achieve success in Lebanon, of course. Hezbollah, 2,500 Islamic Revolutionary Guards were sent to fight the Israelis in the south. But after the Israeli army entered Lebanon and besieged Palestinian forces in Beirut in the summer of 1982, the Iranians had to withdraw to the Bekaa Valley in the northeast. And they established a base in the city of Baalbek, populated mostly by Shiites. This became a separate republic in the Iranian mind. They introduced schools, all kinds of charitable organizations. They wanted to build a separate, small republic of Baalbek. Had Iranian hospitals, centers for training Shiite fighters in guerrilla warfare. Hezbollah, of course, was central. So they proclaimed the Baalbek Islamic Republic of Lebanon in December of 89. Syrians were there too. Armed Syrians were there, as well as their intelligence was there. They were always allies with the Iranians. The Lebanese army tried to wage war against it and failed miserably. Today, Hezbollah still controls the town, despite Israel regularly destroying its hospitals many times over. Even last year, killed 19. Sudan was the one place where they had some success. I've done a whole section, a whole lecture on General Omar Bashir. But he declared the country would be based on the teachings of Khomeini. Since the early 90s, Iranian influence on Sudan had been growing, especially in economics. The IRGC was there. 200 Iranian intelligence officers were sent to Sudan. And, of course, Hezbollah had training camps there. Hassan al-Darabi, who began his career at the Sudanese branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, became that leader of the Sudanese Revolution. His ideology was close to Khomeini. Again, it's the same kind of thing. He tried to impose the Iranian model. In 1994, he said, Sudan is now the most Islamic state in the world, even more Islamic than Iran. So they created this very Islamic society. But in 1999, the Sufi Brotherhoods, which is this omnipresent sect of so-called purified Islam, allegedly played a crucial role in General Bashir's refusal to continue to cooperate. Well, since then, as we all know, Bashir has been overthrown. Sudan split in half. So what happened? Well, the result of all this was that today, Sudan, I think, may be the poorest country on the planet. South Sudan might be. I think it is. They have no hope for the future, and that's not going to change. We talked about Ali Shariati. Eventually, he left Iran. He went a little bit too far. You know, in the West, he studied under the Frankfurt School, but also read Arnold Toynbee, Franz Fanon, Arnold Toynbee, and certain Marxists. I don't know. That's kind of like my agenda in grad school. I was all over the place. He was educated at the Sorbonne, sociology, philosophy, etc. He was there at lectures for by Eric Fromm, Weber, Durkheim, Herbert Marcuse, Jean-Paul Sartre. I don't know. You could see this as a socialist part of Iranian National Socialist, maybe. Sartre, or Sartre's existentialism, had a tremendous influence on Shariati's philosophy. He had a doctorate in history, and he returned to Iran. As I said before, he became one of the most prominent ideologists of the Islamic resistance to the monarchy. But the ideology was extremely powerful. They had some borrowings from Marxism. He even went so far as to replace the traditional formula, in the name of Allah, the merciful, the compassionate, with in the name of God, with the dispossessed. He condemned the clergy of the Shiites as being quietist. A little odd, since they were about to overthrow the Shah. But he, you know, being a student of the Frankfurt School, making his own reality up was pretty normal. He said, well, they're all quietists because they're waiting for the Messiah, so they don't have to do anything. Utter nonsense. So he created a Persian translation of Fanon's The Cursed. He created the opposition of oppressors and oppressed, and he used the Quranic terms, Mus Takbirin, or the arrogant, and the Mus Tadafin, the dispossessed. They're very similar sounding. So he transferred a version of class struggle into the Islamic lexicon. In fact, gave it a central place. Shiite principles of the Talid idea and the Talid, which is a different story. Talid is the voluntary adherence to the instructions of authority, concealing one's true beliefs, death in the name of God and the war against the infidels, etc. He thought that this, it excited him because he saw this in the three principles of Latin American revolutionary guerrillas. He doesn't say who, but compliance with the conditions of guerrilla warfare, unconditional execution of the leadership, and the readiness to die. Well, I don't know. Those aren't really principles. It's kind of, if you're a guerrilla, that's what you have to do. They're not principles. It's just, by definition, that's what you are. Anyway, eventually his works were banned. He went too far. Clearly he had deviated. Khomeini wrote in 1970, and it became, as I had mentioned, became very powerful. Islamic authority, the rule of the theologian lawyer. I want to say theologian jurist. It cites the Quran fewer than 10 times in 150 pages. That was held under suspicion. But the practicalities of rule under these conditions were more significant than the literal understanding of the Quran. So let me summarize here before I let you go. 1979, the victory, the revolution, it was real, it was done. Let me give the three main tenets of Khomeini at this point. The principle of Vilayet al-Faqih, the guidance of the theologian legalist, replacing or even representing the hidden Shiite imam. That makes it possible to create an Islamic state in the modern world, even in the absence of the successor of the Prophet. He had a dichotomous vision of the world, divided into oppressors and oppressed. The interests of the latter, not only Muslims, are protected by the Islamic Revolution. And three, a call to struggle against the satanic forces of the West and the East, meaning the U.S. and the USSR. Today, it's just the West. The Islamic Republic still adheres to this. It gave birth to a new political ideology. The revolution created a political religion almost, a political Islam. It's a religious political ideology. And although we reject Islam wholeheartedly, in the Shiite version, we can respect it. A lot of the things that he was doing, we're doing. But the revolution also is a social and economic doctrine. Khomeini still looms very large over Iranian society. Of course, it's a theocracy. That is, it's a type of government where political power is exercised from the standpoint of religious regulation of the state and public life, clerical or otherwise. But there's a democratic element, too. I've gone to great pains talking about the parties. They're supposed to be Islamic, but that's no big deal. Parties in Israel have to be Jewish. Parties in the U.S. have to be liberal. I mean, you can't be nationalist anywhere, really, in Europe. There's a full-fledged parliament that's elected. Citizens have universal suffrage. The president of the country is elected in general elections. And it's a multi-party system. And, as we all know, today, it's proven itself a match for the U.S. and anyone else who wants to take it on. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.